Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Right after the September 11th terrorist attacks, President George W. Bush declared, quote, "Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated." End quote. With that declaration, the United States unleashed its military might on Afghanistan on October 7, 2001. 2 years later, on March 20, 2003, the United States invaded Iraq. President George W. Bush's so-called war on terror also included the establishment of the Patriot Act, the suspension of civil liberties, the creation of the Guantanamo Bay prison camp, and the kidnapping and torture of terror suspects. Today's guest, Dr. Rebecca Gordon, says that to this day, the people of the United States have never had a full accounting of all that has been done in our name. In her new book, American Nuremberg, she writes, quote, "While the press occasionally exposes the dark side of the war on terror, and congressional investigators sometimes raise alarms about the abuses committed by U.S. intelligence agencies and armed forces, no high U.S. official has been prosecuted for these violations, which many legal observers around the world consider war crimes," end quote. So who should be held responsible for war crimes? How do you define a war crime? And what does accountability mean? Rebecca Gordon is professor of philosophy at the University of San Francisco and a regular contributor to Tom Dispatch. Her last book, Mainstreaming Torture, reveals how torture has been sanitized in the United States. Her latest book is American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. And Rebecca Gordon joins me in studio. Hi, Rebecca. Thank you for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So it is so hard to believe that it's been 15 years since the 9/11 terror attacks, and we are still living with the consequences of 9/11. It really set the stage for the national security state. And it's so interesting because you rarely hear from Bush administration officials in the news. Why did you decide to write this book now, 15 years later?
That's a really good question. And to be perfectly frank, I didn't decide to write the book. The editor came to me and asked me to write it. And he asked me because he heard me on the radio talking about my first book. But to be honest, I was not happy with the title. I did not like the idea of writing a book and calling it Nuremberg, because I'm a child of a Jewish father who lived through World War II. I grew up understanding that the crimes of the Nazis and also of Japan were among the greatest crimes that had ever been committed in the history of the world. But the more I looked at it, the more I realized that unless somebody holds these people accountable, we are going to continue to see crimes committed in our name. So, for example, if you followed at all the Republican campaign for the presidency, you'll notice that all of the candidates have been competing with each other to see who can promise to commit the most war crimes in the future. So this story is not over. The impunity, the lack of consequences for the people who committed crimes in the Bush administration and sadly also in the Obama administration has contributed to the atmosphere in which today the Pew Research Organization every few years does surveys about torture. The further we get away from 9/11, the more people in this country are comfortable with the idea of torture. Mm. So in a sense, the fact that nobody has been prosecuted means that we have normalized. We now accept as perfectly normal things that before September 11th, we would never even have considered.
It's also so interesting when you look back during the Bush administration, the officials used 9/11 over and over again. I mean, everything was done in the name of 9/11. Now, the Obama administration has continued many of those policies, but he rarely talks about 9/11.
No, that's exactly right. And in fact, early on, there was a story that went around that they had decided to retire the language global war on terror. But what we still hear about is international terrorism. We now, of course, have a major focus on ISIS or ISIL or Daesh, whatever you want to call it, the so-called Islamic State. And this has become, in effect, the substitute for the pretext that the war on that 9/11 gave beforehand for continuing essentially a military response. spread out all over the world to what is really not essentially a military problem.
Now, the precedent that was set during the Nuremberg trials is really important. You write that between November 1945 and April 1949, the four countries known as the Great Powers, the U.S., the Soviet Union, Great Britain, and France, tried nearly 200 Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg in Germany. Hundreds more were later put on trial in Soviet-occupied countries and in West German courts. It was the first time in world history when nations came together and said there needs to be an international forum in which people who commit horrific crimes would have to be brought to justice. So talk about the precedent that this set.
So this is one of the things I think is really important, and that we live in a world of nuclear powers, of unprecedented military power all over the world, and a large portion of it concentrated in our country, the United States. And in that context, I think the rule of international law is crucial, because really, in the end, what do we have except raw power and some kind of commitment not to use that power? Those are the things that are facing each other. But it was important that there be some kind of legitimacy to the project of bringing to trial people who were responsible for a war that not only killed 6 million Jews, but upwards of 85 million people around the world, the majority of them civilians. This was a horror on a scale the world had never seen. I mean, if you want to look at the 20th century, one way you could describe it is it's the century of European barbarism. And so, but the problem was, okay, these are the people who won the war. Everyone was going to say, well, this is victor's justice. And so the question was, how can we establish a procedure that looks at least somewhat legitimate?
And Hitler escaped justice at Nuremberg by committing suicide in the final days of the war, along with some of his top aides.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So some of the very top people were not tried. But to bring it back to the present day, mm-hmm. I don't see Dick Cheney and George W. Bush committing suicide anytime soon. You know, the other thing I want to say about Nuremberg was, for many people, the idea was that this was not the end, but this was the beginning, that Nuremberg would be the model for an ongoing international tribunal that could be a place where justice in the world could happen. Now, and many people thought that many observers, even British observers at the time, thought, well, after we get done with the Germans, then we're going to look at the crimes that were committed by the Allies, by our side, you know, which could include the use of atomic weapons in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It could include the firebombing of European and Japanese cities that killed hundreds of thousands of civilians. And it's very interesting that as they were deciding which crimes to prosecute at Nuremberg, they were very careful not to include any of the crimes that the Germans might look at the Allies and say, well, you committed these crimes too. So, for example, the Blitz, the bombing of England, was not part of the crimes that were the charges that were brought against the Nazis.
So the International Criminal Court, which we have today, is a direct descendant of the Nuremberg tribunals, but it is not a place where U.S. officials can be tried. Why is that?
So this is really a great shame, right? This is a terrible shame for our nation. This International Criminal Court, it took another 50 years, but the idea was that this would be a place where people who ought to be tried in their own countries but weren't being for crimes against humanity, war crimes, crimes against human rights, could be brought to trial. The U.S. participated in the process of developing the court. The U.S. signed the original treaty, but as you know, in the United States, a treaty doesn't become law until the Senate ratifies it. So we were sitting at 9/11 with a signature on the treaty but no ratification, and in 2002, the Bush administration informed the court that we were withdrawing our signature and that we would no longer, and there was no hope of ratification. Now, it's very interesting because the U.S. assists the court. President Obama says wonderful things about the work the court does to try people from Africa, but the U.S., in fact, we went further and passed a law that says it's illegal in any way to assist in bringing any U.S. national to trial at the ICC, and even went so far as to say, and if that happens by accident, that the U.S. military should be mobilized to free that person.
So the Bush administration withdrew its signature to that treaty in 2002, and then Congress passed legislation making it illegal to allow any American to be tried at the International Criminal Court. Was there much pushback against this?
No. In 2002, there was no pushback whatsoever. In fact, you have to remember where we were in 2002. We're talking about less than a year after the attacks of September 11th. The whole U.S. population was being whipped up into a froth of anger and war. And, you know, it's really funny because the very first thing they told us to do to establish normality was go shopping.
I remember that.
It was, you know, you probably remember the posters that you saw in the store windows that had a picture of the American flag with shopping bag handles coming out of it. America, open for business. And we were essentially told, don't worry your pretty little heads. You should be really, really scared, but we're going to protect you. And so, yeah, nobody protested because in 2002, we were the good guys. And having been attacked, in a way, almost wiped out a lot of memory in the rest of the world for some of the things that we had been held in contempt for previously, and the world was at our side. But we very quickly lost that.
It's hard to know this, but I have to ask.
Yes.
What if the Bush administration never withdrew its signature to that treaty? What if Congress had never passed legislation making it illegal to allow an American to be tried at the International Criminal Court?
Then I think that we would be seeing people like George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, former head of the CIA, George Tenet, and a number of other former heads of the CIA. I think we would see them on trial. I honestly do.
And who would make those decisions to bring them to trial?
So that's the ICC itself has a prosecutor. And just like the International Tribunal on Rwanda, on the former Yugoslavia, they have the Rome Statute that created the ICC has a whole set of procedures for how decisions are made. And one of the things that they look at is, are these people being held responsible in their own country? And if that's happening, then the ICC says hands off. But if nothing's happening, and I think it would be very hard to see these people tried in the U.S., sadly. I mean, one thing that President Obama could have done is instead of in January 2009 saying we're going to look forward, not backward, he had said we're going to really look into this and we're going to see whether prosecution should be brought. Then the ICC wouldn't have jurisdiction. But otherwise, yeah, they would have.
Do you think it would play out kind of like what we saw in Chile, for example? A Spanish jurist, Baltasar Garzón Real, issued an international warrant for the arrest of former Chilean President Augusto Pinochet for the alleged deaths and torture of Spanish citizens?
Well, see, yes. This is – okay, so there's a little bit of a difference because in Chile, what they're using is they have a set of laws that allow them to bring to trial people who have – violated human international law, even if they haven't broken Spanish laws. And so Judge Garzón, who is a hero by all accounts, has – it's not only Pinochet, but most recently in Spain, they have attempted to extradite a guy named Montana, who is actually living outside of Boston. He's a Salvadoran. He is one of the people responsible at the highest level for the murder of the six Jesuits and their daughter or their housekeeper and her daughter in San Salvador in 1989. This guy has now, the U.S. has actually cleared the way for him to be extradited and tried in Spain. The difference is that that's a Spanish proceeding as opposed to an international proceeding. But I wouldn't say no.
Well, and The Guardian has written about these judges who are using the doctrine of universal jurisdiction to investigate human rights abuses in addition to Chile, in Guatemala, in Chad, and Argentina.
Right, exactly. And I want to give a shout out here to a couple of organizations that have really participated. One is our own Center for Justice and Accountability here in San Francisco with $1.5 million budget. They are responsible for bringing Rios Montt of Guatemala, Montana, and these other people to justice. And they do amazing work. So, yeah. And these judges in countries, another one is Switzerland, also has laws of universal jurisdiction. And in fact, in 2014, former President Bush had been invited to go to Switzerland and give a speech or something. When it turned out that there might be a warrant for his arrest circulating somewhere in Switzerland, he just didn't go. And to be honest, I don't think that people like Bush and Cheney are actually traveling outside the U.S. very much these days.
You know, I remember that, and I was reading a little bit about it for today's show. How would that work, for example? I mean, PolitiFact has a piece called "Are George W. Bush and Dick Cheney Unable to Visit Europe Due to Threat of Arrest?"
Right, and that's the question, right? I suspect that, and this is the thing, you know, prosecuting people who have this much power is literally unthinkable. We cannot think about it because it seems a contradiction, right? But here we have these judges saying, you know, if you actually look at what the law says, these people are liable for crimes. And in a way, that's what I did in the book, too. I tried to break down the idea that it is unthinkable that people at the very highest level of U.S. government could be responsible for things that are actually prosecutable.
Today we are speaking with Rebecca Gordon. She is a professor of philosophy at the University of San Francisco. Her latest book is American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. Rebecca's last book is Mainstreaming Torture, which reveals how torture has been sanitized in the United States. And in the book, Rebecca writes that while the press exposes the dark side of the war on terror and politicians sometimes raise alarms about abuses committed by U.S. intelligence agencies, no high U.S. official has been prosecuted for these violations. Many legal observers around the world consider them to be war crimes. So what do you think about her argument? What questions do you have about war crimes? How would you define it? What does accountability mean? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Later in the show, we're also going to talk about former Senator Bob Graham's calls to release 28 pages of classified information about 9/11 that he says is so revealing about who funded 9/11. So if you have any questions about that, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So you said that you were a little hesitant when your editors came to you with the American Nuremberg title, but then once you did the research, you were more comfortable with it. So based on the research you've done, like, for example, these Spanish judges, do they look to Nuremberg?
Oh, absolutely. They do look to Nuremberg as a precedent, and they look to the Nuremberg principles, and they also look at the three different classes of crimes that Nuremberg decided to prosecute. And these are crimes against peace, war crimes, and this new category, crimes against humanity. So yes, they do look to Nuremberg and they look to international covenants that have been passed since, treaties that have been signed since Nuremberg, for example, the UN Convention Against Torture. And yeah, but Nuremberg set the precedent. Nuremberg said there is that international law is real law, that it's not just nice ideas up in the sky or written down on paper, but that it is real law which can have real teeth, for which there can be real consequences if you break it.
And there were real consequences because the Nuremberg trials took 11 months. 20 people, including high government officials, military officers, were put on trial. How did that court decide who should be tried?
That's a very interesting question, and a lot of it was really political. But what they tried to do was look at who are the people who are responsible at the very highest levels for the various crimes that they're talking about. So they were looking at all the people who were still left alive at the, you know, in the very highest levels of the Nazi Party and the German government. They also tried one of the bankers who bankrolled the activity. Now, there were a lot of people who actually weren't tried. And I don't focus on this much in my book, but there was a whole secret operation called Operation Paperclip, and whose purpose was essentially to bring Germans who might be useful to the United States in the new war, the new front that was opening up, which was basically against the Soviet Union. So our ally of, you know, a year before was now our enemy. And so we brought in scientists. We brought in like Werner von Braun, for example, and we assisted some Nazis to escape. There's no question about that. But the people at the very top were brought to trial. Many of them were hung, and I'm no fan of capital punishment myself. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'm no fan of prison myself. But in this situation at that time, that was what, in a symbolic way, marked the most devastating thing you could do to say this is a crime at the very highest level.
And isn't it true that one of the major achievements of the Nuremberg trial was that no one was allowed to say that they were just following orders?
Absolutely. And this became part of what's called the Nuremberg Principles. And the Nuremberg Principles include the idea that everyone is responsible for obeying the laws and customs of war, even people at the very highest level of government, that no one, by virtue of being in government, has impunity, and that everyone at whatever level is required to take into account international laws and customs of war, and that this following orders defense is not permitted. Absolutely.
So how should that apply to the young soldiers who tortured prisoners at Abu Ghraib? Because what we heard from people above them was that they're just a few bad apples and that they were following orders.
Well, okay. So, yeah. And in fact, the people who've been punished are people like Charles Grainer and Lindy England, who's the woman that you've seen the famous photograph where she's leading a naked Iraqi man on a leash with a collar around his throat. Yeah, those people did wrong things and they went to jail. But nobody at a level above a lieutenant has gone to jail for those things. And it's now very clear that what they did with the direction of people at the highest levels of the Defense Department. So, for example, General Jeffrey Miller, was in charge of Guantanamo. And he is the person who put into place the 10 different techniques that Donald Rumsfeld approved in his famous memo for interrogations at Guantanamo. And we now know that much worse things than those 10 techniques were also done. But he was sent to Iraq to run the detention centers in Iraq, including Abu Ghraib. And his job was to gitmo-ize Abu Ghraib. So clearly, at the same time, we have upstairs from these young, and they weren't even soldiers, they were reservists from Virginia. And what's really interesting is the connection between prison culture in this country and how the U.S. fought the war on terror, because in civilian life, they were prison guards. And there's a famous email that Fredericks, a guy named Fredericks, wrote home to his family that says, "The Christian in me knows it's wrong, but the corrections officer in me loves to see a grown man piss himself."
Mm. We're speaking today with Rebecca Gordon, who teaches philosophy at the University of San Francisco. Her new book is American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. She believes that high-ranking U.S. officials should be held responsible. What would that look like? And is it even possible? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
And I'm Matt Martin, General Manager of KALW, here with Malihe Razazan, producer of Your Call, taking 2 minutes out of this conversation between Rose and her guest, Rebecca Gordon, to ask for your support for local public radio. Today, we are celebrating the connection between public radio and public education. And I think this program, Your Call, day in and day out, is really a public education resource, letting you know what is happening in your world, how government and corporations work, how you get involved. That's what we're asking you to support when you make a call to 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917, or click the Donate Now button at KALW.org.
That's right, Matt, KALW.org or 800-525-9917. I really hope our listeners appreciate our efforts in bringing historical context to events of today and the consequences it has had on our lives. And that is what your call has been doing day in, day out, providing context, news, information, and analysis from a diverse range of sources. 1-800-525-9917 and an easy click, klw.org, where you can go and donate. 1-800-525-9917. And if you support this kind of programming, appreciate the fact that we have always tried to push the envelope for trying new things on your call. And the way we cover topics that are important to you, give us a call. 1-800-525-9917.
And if you've been interested by Rebecca Gordon and what she's had to say about war crimes and the potential for really putting this people on trial, if you want to learn more about this, her book, America Nuremberg, is yours for a $120 contribution to KALW. Our thanks for your support at 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
And today we are joined by Rebecca Gordon. She teaches philosophy at the University of San Francisco. She also writes for Tom Dispatch. Her latest book is American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. And if you have a question or a comment for Rebecca, her last book was about torture, so she really studies these issues closely. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Before the break, we were talking about Abu Ghraib, and you mentioned the man, and his name escapes
Fredericks.
Me. Frederick. Where is he now?
I don't know. He's presumably back in civilian life, probably continuing to work as a prison guard. Oh. And yeah. But well, Jeffrey Miller, he's still a general.
The other thing about the Nuremberg principles, they declare that actions that violate international law are punishable crimes, regardless of whether these actions violate domestic law. So how would that apply to the case of the United States and its actions in Iraq and Afghanistan, from the black sites to the torture to the treatment of prisoners? You know, what about the people who had nothing to do with 9/11? How would that apply?
Well, it completely applies. Obviously, our first reaction to 9/11 was not to treat it as what it was, which was a terrible crime, but to treat it as an act of war. We then proceeded to attack a country which was tangentially connected, but not directly connected. Mm-hmm. And then we proceeded, and here I want to say one of the things that's unusual in this book is, I mean, a lot of people have written about the torture and renditions and kidnappings, all of these terrible things. But there's another crime that's sitting right in front of us that is so big that nobody has even recognized it as a crime. At Nuremberg, the first crime, the one at the top of the list, and it was actually the U.S. and Great Britain that insisted on this, was what's called the crime against peace, which means making an unprovoked, aggressive war against another country. Under the UN Charter, under treaties that the U.S. has signed, including one that goes back to 1928 called the Kellogg-Briand Treaty, it is illegal under international law to attack a country that has not attacked you. And the right of self-defense does not include saying that someday in the distant future someone might have a weapon that might be able to hurt us. And so as early as March of 2001, so long before September 11th, the Cheney administration, but Dick Cheney was meeting in secret meetings with heads of the oil companies. And a lot of people don't remember, but it was the biggest deal at the time, was the question of why are these meetings secret? Why can't we know how this national energy policy is actually being created? And it turns out that one of the things that they were discussing is the need to remove Saddam Hussein, to continue with a plan that comes out of the 1990s, from the Project for a New American Century, to essentially remake the Middle East in a model that the U.S. thought would be more conducive to the interests, frankly, not of the people of this country, but the oil companies of this country. So they were always already thinking about attacking Iraq. And so when September 11th came along, that gave the perfect opportunity. And I think we don't have a sense of just how destructive, first the sanctions regime that was already in place on Iraq, but then the war itself. And if you haven't lived through a war on your own territory, you don't understand what it means to ordinary human life. But
well, and this is important because you point out that in this March of 2000 meeting, 2001 meeting with Dick Cheney and the heads of these oil companies, they discussed the importance of removing Saddam Hussein from power in order to open the oil fields for U.S. oil companies, which included Halliburton, Dick Cheney's former company.
Right. And Halliburton gave Dick Cheney a $34 million goodbye gift, a lovely parting gift for his work there, and they were repaid tenfold with $3.4 billion worth of contracts in Iraq, supporting not even the oil fields, but just supporting the military effort in Iraq. So Halliburton made out like bandits, literally thieves. And, you know, it's bribery and corruption at a level that is so big, you can't see it because it's so gigantic. You know, it's like, I don't know, being in front of some giant ball and all you can see is a little tiny piece of it, so you can't see that it's a ball. Mm-hmm. And this is what these crimes are like.
Rebecca Gordon is the author of American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. We've got full lines. Let's hear from Sarah in Berkeley. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, Ms. Gordon, I just thought it was very... I had two questions. One was that I thought it was very poignant when you said that, you know, when September 11th, 2001 happened, that the U.S. was on... the world was on the side of the U.S. And I wondered, you know, sort of that historical moment, if that could ever happen again, and what steps... You know, I guess that kind of goes into the question of, is it even possible to have justice in the way that it would be de facto? And the second question was with regard to the trope of U.S. exceptionalism. I'm wondering how much that plays into the inability to, stand trial or to have top U.S. officials stand trial for these war crimes as it pertains to the ICC and the International Criminal Court. Thank you very much.
Those are both great questions. So I'll start with the second one first, and I think you've actually put your finger right on it. This whole idea that the United States is unique in the world, not only because we have the biggest economy and the biggest military, but because we have some kind of set of values that are deeply felt and are our gift to the entire world, oftentimes comes along with the barrel of a gun. And so this idea then makes it unthinkable that the country that tried the Nazis at Nuremberg could actually be responsible for war crimes, because we are America. We are the United States of America. Everybody knows we are the leaders of the free world, even in a time when the other side of the world, the socialist world, no longer really exists. Still, we are the leaders of the free world. And so I think that exceptionalism comes into play in the minds of Americans ourselves much more than the rest of the world. The rest of the world knows a lot about the United States and its actions. It doesn't have a choice because its actions affect those other nations. We in this country tend to be the most ignorant about the effects of our own nation's activities, but that belief that we are carrying this precious cargo of rights and freedom and dignity into the world makes it very hard for us in this country to imagine that our leaders could be responsible for such terrible things. And it, you know, again, makes it very difficult to try our leaders in the ICC, apart from the fact that it's illegal to do that at this point. And then your first question about whether the world would ever have a moment of compassion for the United States again. I'm not a big fan of the idea that being a victim gives you moral superiority. And I've seen that, you know, that idea advanced in a number of ways, so that the very fact that you've been attacked doesn't mean that necessarily what you do afterwards in response to that carries any special moral quality. But what I do think is that if the world were to see that as a nation we take responsibility for the way that we have behaved and that we accept what's been done in our names, I think that it would change the way that the world sees us. I've been fortunate enough to travel around the world a lot, and one of the things I've found over and over again is just how willing people are in other countries to make a distinction between the U.S. government and the U.S. people. And sometimes I think they give us more credit than we deserve. But I think that also, when I think about accountability and about justice for people who are the victims, very often people who have been tortured, people who have been abused, people who've had war made on their land, the first thing that they want isn't even reparations. It isn't even anything material. It's just a literal acknowledgement of what was done to them, that this was done to you and it was wrong. And the U.S. hasn't even done that.
Well, thank you for calling in, Sarah. Let's go next to Alicia in Berkeley. Hi, Alicia. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's a wonderful show, and I really appreciate Rebecca's work, and especially her comment about the fact that one of our leading presidential candidates is making statements about the torture that he might exact, going beyond waterboarding and just shocking, what I find incredibly shocking statements. And also that the press doesn't seem to pick up on that. And I guess, you know, my question, well, two things. What disturbs me about it, beyond the fact that we seem to be feel comfortable somehow in engaging in the kinds of activities that we're condemning ISIS and other groups for, is that it sort of seems to me be paving the way for us to turn those kinds of tortures on our own citizens if the, you know, conditions were right. And I guess my question would be, what is your opinion about how the press is responding to these kinds of statements in the news?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I read the New York Times, and the New York Times has editorialized several times against exactly what you're talking about. So in a way, it's almost as though the problem isn't that the press isn't noticing, it's that it doesn't matter. Even when the New York Times or the Washington Post says Donald Trump or whoever is proclaiming that he will commit war crimes, and it gets amplified, you see it in the press, but it just disappears. It doesn't matter. And this is, I think, a result of now 15 years of our being conditioned to accept whatever it takes to keep us safe. We're constantly being reminded. I flew last week, this is fresh in my mind. You go to the airport, you take off your shoes, you take off your belt, you take your computer out, you put your little liquids in your exactly quart-sized baggie. It's all this theater that reminds you you should be terrified. But I wanted to respond to something else you said, because I think this is really important, about whether these things can be turned against us. And my answer to that is they already are. The biggest site of torture in the United States today is our own jails and prisons. And it goes on really in plain sight. One of the key ways is, of course, solitary confinement. And we now know that within a couple of weeks, a person who is kept without any human contact, and that's how it works, you're in an 8x10 box that's painted bright white with a video camera in the corner, fluorescent lighting, your food comes to you on a tray that's shoved through a slot in the door. People become psychotic very quickly. And there are people in this country who've endured that for 10, 20, 30, in Angola prison in Louisiana, 40 years. So that's one. The other that is very common, it's so common we think it's funny when we see it on a television show, is rape in prison, which is not an accident. It's actually part of the disciplinary procedures, especially for male prisoners. It's one of the ways that the guards actually control is by allowing certain people to be raped by other people, and that way they manipulate the power structure within prisons. And regular beatings, exposures to heat and cold, all of the things that became familiar to us have gone on in prisons. And Judge Harry Blackmun, who was one of the justices of the Supreme Court, wrote about this back in 1992 and said, you know, these things that we would call torture if they happened outside the U.S. are happening in our own prisons. The other thing that I want to say is that one of the side effects of the war on terror is that the military bought huge amounts of military-style military equipment, which is now being essentially dumped on local police forces. And a few years ago, there were a lot of stories around about, you know, and it's true, in East Oakland, there are armored personnel carriers patrolling the streets. We've gotten used to the whole idea that special weapons and tactics teams, SWAT teams, are a natural form of policing. Well, that's like the house-to-house searches that we did in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And the very weapons that our police now have, including most recently, I saw a paper story in the paper yesterday. I don't remember the name of the city, but it's one of our big cities. One of the things that they've been given, in addition to everything else, is bayonets. Now, I ask you, does a U.S. police force need to confront U.S. people living in this country with knives on their guns? I mean, this makes no sense at all.
Thank you for calling in, Alicia. Today we're speaking with Rebecca Gordon, author of American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. Let's go next to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having this guest. As a Chilean American, I remember as a child what happened on September 11th of 1973.
Yes.
And the effects that basically was one of the first laboratories of the national security state that later on has become par for the course after 9/11 here in the United States, and a lot of things that people would never have thought possible have occurred. Also, the issue of the effect that this has had on basically the actual war crimes that are continuing to be carried out by the drone attacks against civilian mm-hmm. populations, and by the fact that the U.S. Is basically the only country in the world that supports supported Israel during its brutal attack on the Gaza population, with committing war crimes by bombing hospitals and schools and even UN schools. Those things like that have become so commonplace that it's impossible to even fathom. Also, the fact those are basically war crimes, and the U.S. is complicit in that by having given $227 million to Israel during that same period of time.
Also, Lisa, thank you for calling, and we only have a few minutes left, so sorry to cut you off. We actually have a few emails about Israel and what your thoughts are about that.
Okay, so first let me just say, Lisa, that September 11th to me, before 2001, always meant the day of the coup in Chile. And obviously, as you know better than I, our country was complicit in that coup, and that is where a lot of the technology, the technique of torture was developed. So yes, about Israel, because it is a very important question, and it's connected to the wars that the U.S. has supported in the Middle East. Part of the reason that the original plan that the Project for a New American Century actually even brought to Bill Clinton, which he rejected, was to remake the Middle East in a way that would be more friendly both to the U.S. and to Israel. No question that the attacks on Gaza are absolutely war crimes. And I would go back to 2006 and also talk about the attacks on Lebanon. I had just come home from Lebanon when the Israeli Air Force began bombing a number of the places I had just been to visit, including Baalbek, which is ancient Roman ruins. So yeah, there's no question that U.S. support for the settler state of Israel is part and parcel of all of this nexus of crimes that we're talking about. And as a Jew or a nice Jewish girl who goes to an Episcopal church. As the daughter of a Jewish father, I can only say that my hope is, and what I'm beginning to see, is that a younger generation of American Jews are beginning to recognize that we can be Jewish without necessarily supporting every action of the State of Israel.
Thank you for calling in, Alicia. We only have a couple of minutes left, and you have done extensive research on this book, and I just wonder, what are you really wanting people to learn more about 9/11? The one thing that really gets me that a lot of people don't know is that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney refused to testify separately when it came to the 9/11 Commission. They also refused to testify under oath. That's not common knowledge. What else?
Well, then there's the question of the 28 pages, right?
Yes.
So the 9/11 Commission report had 28 pages which were not released, which have been kept classified. And as Bob Graham, Senator Bob Graham, has been telling us, that part of what's contained in those 28 pages is information about the possible responsibility of either members of the Saudi government, Saudi officials, Saudi nationals in financing and promoting the attacks of 9/11. And I was telling Rose before the show, it's really interesting how this, who the 9/11 attackers were, has become almost like this empty slate. And you can write whoever today's enemy is on that slate. So when I was teaching at the University of San Francisco in 2005, 2006, 2007, when students had people fighting in Iraq, they were 100% convinced that the people who flew those planes were Iraqi. A few years later, when they were attempting to gin up a response and an interest in attacking Iran, that next crop of students were convinced that the people who flew those planes were from Iran. And what people don't know or have forgotten is that 15 of the 19 were Saudi nationals. And so it's very interesting that the state that is after Israel, our biggest ally in the Middle East, the Saudi kingdom, is actually probably in some ways responsible for those attacks, and yet that information has been obscured.
Well, it's not surprising they believe that Iraqis were on the plane, because Charles Lewis came out with that book, 935 Lies, that showed the Bush administration consistently made that connection. And then when it comes to these 28 pages, in addition to former Senator Bob Graham, I mean, you've got Nancy Pelosi calling for these pages to be released. The Obama administration says they're going to make a decision by late June. What do you think is going to happen?
I don't know what's going to happen, but I can tell you what people can do, which is they can call the White House, write letters to the White House, and let me tell you, a letter that goes through snail mail counts for a whole lot more than an email. But they should let the White House know that as people of this country, residents or citizens, we want to see those pages. We want to know who attacked us and why. And why was it kept hidden from us?
Do you think we'll eventually get answers?
Yeah, I do, actually. I do. I'm surprised, but I think we might. What will happen as a result of that, I don't know. And, you know, answers are in some ways just the first step. The real question is, what are we going to do to prevent this kind of thing from happening again?
Hmm.
And when I say this kind of thing, I don't mean terrorist attacks, because the reality is we live in a country where anybody can go on the internet and buy a semi-automatic weapon, where anybody can make a bomb. There is nothing we can do that will keep us 100% safe, because we're all going to die one day. But what we can do is say, given that we live in a world in which we are mortal, what is our response going to be? What kind of people do we want to be?
Rebecca Gordon is philosophy professor at the University of San Francisco. Her latest book is American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. Thank you, Rebecca. Thanks for writing this book. And you are going to stick around with us to talk about the importance of public radio. And we are also joined by General Manager Matt Martin.
So good to be here, Rose. After hearing this conversation, the kind of passionate, engaged, informed conversation that you make possible when you support Your Call, when you support KALW, because this is a program that, if you appreciate it, you understand, only would happen here. When you make a call to 800-525-9917 or go to KALW.org, you do make a difference. And Rose and Rebecca, I know you both want to talk, but I want to let folks know there is a challenge before the end of this hour, before we go to World Have Your Say from the BBC. We need 20 people to give their support for local public radio. And if we do that, if we get 20 people to make that call or click, it'll be an additional $800 coming from Charles Tomberg in Foster City, Jacqueline Tona in San Francisco, people who believe in the same kind of resource you do, who have put forward their support right now at 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
Thank you so much for that support. 20 calls or clicks, we'll get an extra $800. You can give us a call at 800-525-9917 for a $120 contribution. We will send you Rebecca Gordon's new book, American Nuremberg. You can also go online to KALW.org. As a professor of philosophy, what does public radio, independent local radio, mean to you, Rebecca?
Independent local radio is my lifeblood. Independent local radio brings me things that I can't get anywhere else. I wake up with KALW. I listen when I want something a little less political on Saturday afternoons. I love the music. And I just, what is so important to me is that this is our community building our radio station. It's accessible to all of us. It makes it possible for someone like me to come on and talk about this book. KALW is a part of our community. It has been a part of our community for so many years.
75 years.
75 years. Diamond anniversary. So you 20 people who enjoyed this conversation, get on those phones.
800-525-9917. Join our community here. Give us a call. You can also go online to KALW.org. As Matt said, we have a generous challenge. Thank you again. If we can get 20 of you to call or click, we'll get an extra $800 to support local independent radio. 800-525-9917. $120. We will send you Rebecca Gordon's new book, which has really interesting information about the Nuremberg trial and the precedent that those trials set. You can also go online to KALW.org.
Every single call or click counts towards this challenge. 800-525-9917, KALW.org. Today on KALW, we've been remembering that this station was started by educators 75 years ago in the public schools here in San Francisco. And this continues to be a resource for public education. We develop new talents here. We bring new voices on the air. And at the same time, we make this resource available for everyone. Ideas, information, they need to reach people across our community. This is one of the places where it happens. Your support makes it possible.
800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Support a station that believes in spending an hour on history. We love doing these kinds of shows. Rebecca Gordon writes this book, does so much research, but she needs an outlet where she can talk about her ideas. And frankly, we've had a lot of authors in the last couple of months say it's really hard to get interviews, but they're getting them on KALW because we believe in ideas and we believe in talking about history, what we can learn. 800-525-9917. $120 will send you Rebecca Gordon's new book, American Nuremberg. You can also go online to KALW.org.
800-525-9917 or KALW.org. The challenge is still there until 5 after the hour. Give your support. It will count towards that challenge at every level of support. We're going to be going to the BBC News headlines in just a moment here on KALW San Francisco. 800-525-9917, KALW.org.